people. I was looking for someone who shared my judicial philosophy and whose values wouldn't change over time. I went into the interviews hoping one person would stand apart. One did. John Roberts flew in from London, where he was teaching for the summer. I knew Roberts' record, top of his class at Harvard and Harvard Law School, law clerk to Justice Rehnquist, dozens of cases argued before the Supreme Court. Roberts had been nominated to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals in 1992, but he wasn't confirmed before the election. I had nominated him to a seat on the same court in 2001. He was confirmed in 2003 and had established a solid record. Behind the sparkling resume was a genuine man with a gentle soul. He had a quick smile and spoke with passion about the two young children he and his wife Jane had adopted. His command of the law was obvious, as was his character. I talked about the decision with Dick, Harriet, Andy, Al, and Carl. They liked Roberts, but he was not at the top of all lists. Dick and Al backed Luddick, who they felt was the most dedicated conservative jurist. Harriet supported Alito because he had the most established judicial record. Andy and Carl shared my inclination toward Roberts. I solicited opinions from others, including some of the younger lawyers in the White House. One was Brett Kavanaugh, whom I had nominated to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. Brett told me that Luddick, Alito, and Roberts would all be solid justices. The tiebreaker question, he suggested, was which man would be the most effective leader on the court, the most capable of convincing his colleagues through persuasion and strategic thinking. I believed Roberts would be a natural leader. I didn't worry about him drifting away from his principles over time. He described his philosophy of judicial modesty with a baseball analogy that stuck with me. A good judge is like an umpire, and no umpire thinks he is the most important person on the field. On Tuesday, July 19th, I called John to offer him the job. We made the announcement that night in the East Room. Everything went according to plan until, during my primetime televised speech, 4-year-old Jack Roberts slipped out of his mother's grip and started dancing around the floor. We later learned he was imitating Spider-Man. I saw him out of the corner of my eye, and it took all my concentration to continue my remarks. Eventually, Jane reclaimed little Jack. The audience had a good laugh, and Jack's family got slideshow material for life. In early September, 3 days before Robert's confirmation hearing was scheduled to begin, Carl called me late on a Saturday night. Laura and I were in bed, and nobody calls with good news at that hour. Carl told me the Chief Justice had just died. Rehnquist was one of the greats. He had served 33 years on the Supreme Court, 19 of them in the center chair. He had conducted Dad's swearing-in as president in 1989 and mine in 2001. As my second inauguration approached, Rehnquist was ailing with thyroid cancer. He hadn't been seen in public for weeks. But when it came time to read the oath of office, his voice boomed loud and clear. "Repeat after me. I, George Walker Bush, do solemnly swear." I now had two vacancies on the court to fill. I decided that John Roberts' leadership ability made him a perfect fit for Chief Justice. John excelled at his hearing, was confirmed by a wide majority, and came back to the East Room for his swearing-in. The moment showed what unlikely turns life can take. John Roberts, who 13 years earlier assumed that his chance to be a judge had passed, was now Chief Justice of the United States. With O'Connor's seat still vacant, I felt strongly that I should replace her with a woman. I didn't like the idea of the Supreme Court having only one woman, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Laura agreed and shared her views with the press. This was a rare occasion when Laura's advice spilled out into the public, but far from the only time I relied on her thoughtful counsel. Laura had an instinctive feel for the pulse of the country. She wasn't involved in every issue, and she didn't want to be. She picked areas that appealed to her, including education, women's health, rebuilding the Gulf Coast after Katrina, AIDS and malaria, and freedom in Burma and Afghanistan. I instructed Harriet and the search committee to draw up a new list with more women. The candidates she found were impressive, but there were frustrating roadblocks. When I asked for a more thorough vetting of one well-qualified woman judge, it turned out that her husband had a financial problem that would jeopardize her confirmation. A top choice on the list was Priscilla Owen, a former justice on the Texas Supreme Court. Priscilla was one of the first people I nominated for a federal appeals court position in 2001. Unfortunately, Democrats made her a target. She was finally confirmed in the spring of 2005 as part of a bipartisan compromise. I thought she would make a fine member of the Supreme Court. But a number of senators, including Republicans, told me the fight would be bloody and ultimately she would not be confirmed. Two other messages came from our consultations on Capitol Hill. The first was that I should think about picking a lawyer from outside the bench. The second was that I seriously consider my White House counsel, Harriet Myers. Several senators had been very impressed by Harriet as she shepherded John Roberts through his interviews on Capitol Hill. I liked the idea of nominating Harriet. She had been a legal pioneer in Texas, the first woman president of a major Texas law firm, the Dallas Bar Association, and the State Bar of Texas. She had been elected to the Dallas City Council, directed the Texas Lottery Commission, and served nearly 5 years in top White House positions. There was no doubt in my mind that she shared my judicial philosophy and that her outlook would not change. She would make an outstanding justice. I asked Harriet if she had any interest in the job. She was surprised, more like shocked, but she said she would serve if I asked. I raised the idea with other members of the search group. Harriet's colleagues loved and respected her, and some thought she would be a good choice. Others argued that it was too risky to pick someone with no established record on the bench, or that we would be accused of cronyism. Several told me bluntly that she was not the right choice. None told me to expect the firestorm of criticism we received from our supporters. The decision came down to Harriet and Priscilla Owen. I decided to go with Harriet. I knew her better. I thought she had a better chance to be confirmed. And she would bring a unique perspective to the court as someone outside the judicial fraternity. Initially, a number of senators and judges praised the selection. Their voices, however, were quickly drowned out. On the right, initial whispers of disbelief turned to howls of incredulity. How could I name someone with so little experience? How could they trust the judicial philosophy of someone they didn't know? It seemed to me that there was another argument against Harriet, one that went largely unspoken. How could I name someone who did not run in elite legal circles? Harriet had not gone to an Ivy League school. Her personal style compounded the doubts. She is not glib. She is not fancy. She thinks hard before she speaks, a trait so rare in Washington that it was mistaken for intellectual slowness. As one conservative critic condescendingly put it, however nice, helpful, prompt, and tidy she is, Harriet Myers isn't qualified to play a Supreme Court justice on the West Wing, let alone to be a real one. All of these criticisms came from so-called friends. When the left started criticizing Harriet, too, I knew the nomination was doomed. After 3 terrible weeks, I got a call in my office in the Treaty Room, where I was working late in the evening. The White House operator told me Harriet was on the phone. In a steady, composed voice, she informed me that she thought it best that she withdraw from consideration for the Supreme Court. As much as it pained me, I agreed. While I know Harriet would have made a fine justice, I didn't think enough about how the selection would be perceived by others. I put my friend in an impossible situation. If I had to do it over again, I would not have thrown Harriet to the wolves of Washington. The morning after the announcement, Harriet reported to work, just like on any other day. She went office to office in the West Wing, lifting the spirits of the many colleagues, junior and senior, who were saddened to see a person they admired treated so wrongly. When she came to the Oval Office, I said, "Thank goodness you withdrew. I still have a great lawyer." She smiled and said, "Mr. President, I am ready to lead the search for your next nominee. I had to get the next pick right. While the idea of selecting a woman still appealed to me, I could not find any as qualified as Sam Alito. Sam is as reserved as they come. When we first sat down for the interview, he seemed ill at ease. I tried the old common ground icebreaker, in this case baseball. Sam is a huge Philadelphia Phillies fan. As we talked about the game, his body language changed. He opened up a little about his life and the law. He was scholarly, but practical. He had been a federal prosecutor in New Jersey before moving to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in 1990. His opinions were well-grounded and tightly argued. There was no doubt he would adhere strictly to the Constitution. 4 days after Harriet withdrew, I met with Sam in the Oval Office and offered him the job. He accepted. Our supporters were elated. Our critics knew they would not be able to block Sam's confirmation, but they subjected him to a nasty hearing anyway. They tried to paint him as a racist, a radical, a bigot, anything they could think of, all based on zero evidence. I was disgusted by the demagoguery. As one senator recounted the false charges, Sam's wife, Martha Ann, broke into tears. Her reaction was so genuine that even some Democrats realized they had gone too far. After the Senate confirmed Sam to the court, I invited him and his family to the White House for his swearing-in. Before we went out for the ceremony, I had a moment alone with Sam. I thanked him for enduring the hearings and wished him well in the court. Then I said, "Sam, you ought to thank Harriet Myers for making this possible." He replied, "Mr. President, you're exactly right." The most emotional personnel decision I had to make was the last one of my presidency. The roots of my dilemma stretched back to the summer of 2003. Our troops in Iraq had not found the weapons of mass destruction we all expected, and the media's scramble for a scapegoat had commenced. In my 2003 State of the Union address, I had cited a British intelligence report that Iraq sought to buy uranium from Niger. The single sentence in my 5,000-word speech was not a major point in the case against Saddam. The British stood by the intelligence. Yet those 16 words became a political controversy and a massive distraction. In July 2003, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson wrote a New York Times column alleging that the administration had ignored his skeptical findings when he traveled to Africa to investigate the Iraq-Niger connection. There were serious questions about the accuracy and thoroughness of Wilson's report, but his charge became a prime talking point for critics of the war. Shortly after Wilson's op-ed, longtime Washington columnist Bob Novak reported that Wilson had been sent to Niger not by Dick Cheney or any senior member of the administration, as Wilson had suggested, but on the recommendation of his wife, Valerie Plame, who worked at the CIA. Then it came out that Wilson's wife's position was classified. Critics alleged that someone in my administration had committed a crime by intentionally leaking the identity of a CIA operative. The Justice Department named a special prosecutor to investigate. I was inherently skeptical of special prosecutors. I remembered how Lawrence Walsh had politicized his investigation of Iran-Contra during the 1992 campaign. But an intelligence leak was a serious matter, and I directed my staff to cooperate fully. U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald interviewed most of the team, including me. Early in the process, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage informed Fitzgerald that he had provided Novak with the information about Plame. Nevertheless, the special prosecutor continued to investigate. Over the course of more than 2 years, Fitzgerald brought numerous administration officials before a grand jury, including Dick's chief of staff, Scooter Libby. After two appearances by Scooter, Fitzgerald produced an indictment for perjury, obstruction of justice, and making false statements. Scooter went to trial and was convicted. In June 2007, he was sentenced to 30 months in prison. I faced an agonizing decision. I could let Scooter go to jail. I could use my power under the Constitution to grant him a pardon. Or I could commute his sentence meaning his conviction would stand, but his prison sentence would not. Some in the White House, led by the vice president, pushed aggressively for a pardon. Their argument was that the investigation should never have proceeded after Fitzgerald had identified Novak's source. On the other hand, most advisers believed that the jury verdict was correct and should remain in place. I decided it would send a bad message to pardon a former staff member convicted of obstructing justice, especially after I had instructed the staff to cooperate with the investigation. But the punishment Scooter had received did not fit the crime. The protracted investigation and trial had already caused personal, professional, and financial damage for Scooter and his family. In early July 2007, I announced my decision. I respect the jury's verdict, but I have concluded that the prison sentence given to Mr. Libby is excessive. Therefore, I am commuting the portion of Mr. Libby's sentence that required him to spend 30 months in prison. The reaction from the left was blistering. President Bush's action today tells America that it's okay to lie, mislead, and obstruct justice, as long as you are loyal to his administration, one congressman said. Another said, I call on House Democrats to reconsider impeachment proceedings. Not everyone in the White House liked the decision, either. Dick continued to advocate a full pardon. One of the biggest surprises of my presidency was the flood of pardon requests at the end. I could not believe the number of people who pulled me aside to suggest that a friend or former colleague deserved a pardon. At first I was frustrated, then I was disgusted. I came to see massive injustice in the system. If you had connections to the president, you could insert your case into the last-minute frenzy. Otherwise, you had to wait for the Justice Department to conduct a review and make a recommendation. In my final weeks in office, I resolved that I would not pardon anyone who went outside the formal channels. In the closing days of the administration, Dick pressed his case that Scooter should be pardoned. Scooter was a decent man and dedicated public servant, and I understood the ramifications for his family. I asked two trusted lawyers to review the case from top to bottom, including the evidence presented at the trial for and against Scooter. I also authorized them to meet with Scooter to hear his side of the story. After careful analysis, both lawyers told me they could find no justification for overturning the jury's verdict. I spent our last weekend at Camp David wrestling with the decision. Just make up your mind, Laura told me. You're ruining this for everyone. Ultimately, I reached the same conclusion I had in 2007. The jury verdict should be respected. In one of our final meetings, I informed Dick that I would not issue a pardon. He stared at me with an intense look. I can't believe you're going to leave a soldier on the battlefield, he said. The comment stung. In 8 years, I had never seen Dick like this, or even close to this. I worried that the friendship we had built was about to be severely strained at best. A few days later, I talked to another person about the pardon process. On the ride up Pennsylvania Avenue on Inauguration Day, I told Barack Obama about my frustrations with the pardon system. I gave him a suggestion. Announce a pardon policy early on and stick to it. After President Obama's inauguration, Laura and I choppered to Andrews Air Force Base. Our final event before boarding the plane home to Texas was a farewell ceremony in front of 3,000 friends, family, and former staff. Dick had agreed to introduce me. He had injured his back moving boxes, so Lynn had to push him onto the stage in a wheelchair. Dick grabbed the microphone. I had no idea what he would say. I hoped he would be able to get past the disappointment he felt. His words were heartfelt and kind. 8.5 years ago, I began a partnership with George Bush that has truly been a special honor. If I have one regret, it is only that these days have ended and that all the members of this fine team now must go their own way. The man I picked that hot day in July remained steady to the end. Our friendship had survived. Chapter 4. Stem Cells. In the heart of central London sat a 34-story gray building. One floor contained a large open space known as the fertilizing room. Inside, technicians meticulously mixed eggs and sperm in test tubes to produce the next generation. The hatchery served as the lifeblood of a new world government, which had mastered the formula for engineering a productive and stable society. That scene was not the creation of Jay Lefkowitz, the bright lawyer reading aloud to me in the Oval Office in 2001. It came from Aldous Huxley's 1932 novel, Brave New World. With the recent breakthroughs in biotechnology and genetics, the book now seemed chillingly relevant. So did its lesson. For all its efficiency, Huxley's utopian world seemed sterile, joyless, and empty of meaning. The quest to perfect humanity ended in the loss of humanity. In April of that same year, another piece of writing turned up in the Oval Office. Describing what she called a wrenching family journey, the author urged me to support the miracle possibilities of embryonic stem cell research to provide cures for people like her husband, who was suffering from Alzheimer's. She closed, "Mr. President, I have some personal experience regarding the many decisions you face each day. I'd be very grateful if you would take my thoughts and prayers into your consideration on this critical issue. Most sincerely, Nancy Reagan." The juxtaposition of Mrs. Reagan's letter and the Huxley novel framed the decision I faced on stem cell research. Many felt the federal government had a responsibility to fund medical research that might help save the lives of people like President Reagan. Others argued that supporting the destruction of human embryos could take us off a moral cliff toward an uncaring society that devalued life. The contrast was stark, and I faced a difficult decision. Sometimes our differences run so deep it seems we share a continent but not a country, I said in my inaugural address on January 20, 2001. We do not accept this, and we will not allow it. Our unity, our union, is the serious work of leaders and citizens in every generation, and this is my solemn pledge. I will work to build a single nation of justice and opportunity. After a luncheon with dignitaries at the Capitol, Laura and I made our way to the White House as part of the official inaugural parade. Pennsylvania Avenue was lined by well-wishers, along with a few pockets of protesters. They carried big signs with foul language, hurled eggs at the motorcade, and screamed at the top of their lungs. I spent most of the ride in the presidential limo behind thick glass windows, so their shouting came across in pantomime. While I couldn't make out their words, their middle finger spoke loudly. The bitterness of the 2000 election was not going away anytime soon. Laura and I watched the rest of the parade from the reviewing stand at the White House. We waved to the marchers from every state, and were thrilled to see high school bands from Midland and Crawford. After the parade, I went to check out the Oval Office. As I walked over from the residence, the room looked like it was glowing. Its bright lights and gold drapes stood out in vivid contrast from the dark winter sky. Each president decorates the Oval Office in his own style. I hung several Texas paintings, including Julian Onderdonk's renditions of the Alamo, a West Texas landscape, and a field of bluebonnets, a daily reminder of our ranch in Crawford. I also brought a painting called Rio Grande from an El Paso artist and friend, Tom Leah, and a scene of a horseman charging up a hill by W.H.D. Corner. The name of the piece, A Charge to Keep, echoed a Methodist hymn by Charles Wesley, which we sang at my first inauguration as governor. Both the painting and hymn reflect the importance of serving a cause larger than oneself. I decided to keep the Rembrandt Peale portrait of George Washington that Dad and Bill Clinton had placed over the mantel. I added busts of Abraham Lincoln, Dwight Eisenhower, and Winston Churchill, a gift on loan from the British government courtesy of Prime Minister Tony Blair. I had told Tony that I admired Churchill's courage, principle, and sense of humor, all of which I thought were necessary for leadership. My favorite example of Churchill's wit was his reply when Franklin Roosevelt caught him coming out of the tub on a visit to the White House in December 1941. "I have nothing to hide from the President of the United States," he said. After 9/11, I realized the three busts had something in common. All depicted wartime leaders. I certainly didn't have that in mind when I chose them. One space on the wall was reserved for the president's most influential predecessor. I chose Lincoln. He'd had the most trying job of any president, preserving the Union. Some asked why I didn't put Dad's portrait in that spot. "Number 41 hangs in my heart," I said. 16 is on the wall." The centerpiece of the Oval Office was the Resolute Desk. I had chosen the desk because of its historical significance. Its story began in 1852 when Queen Victoria dispatched the HMS Resolute to search for the British explorer John Franklin, who had been lost looking for the Northwest Passage. The Resolute was trapped in ice near the Arctic and abandoned by its crew. In 1855, it was discovered by an American whaling ship, which sailed the Resolute back to Connecticut. The vessel was purchased by the U.S. government, refitted, and returned to England as a goodwill gift to the Queen. When the Resolute was decommissioned 2 decades later, Her Majesty had several ornate desks made out of its timbers, one of which she gave to President Rutherford B. Hayes. Most presidents since Hayes have used the Resolute desk in one capacity or another. Franklin Roosevelt commissioned a front panel door with a carved presidential seal, which some historians believe was intended to hide his wheelchair. Little John F. Kennedy Jr. poked his head out that door in the most famous Oval Office photo ever taken. Dad had used the Resolute in his upstairs office in the residence, while Bill Clinton returned it to the Oval. Sitting behind the historic desk was a reminder, that first day and every day, that the institution of the presidency is more important than the person who holds it. Andy Card was with me as I took my place at the Resolute for the first time. My first Oval Office decision was to replace the desk chair, a bizarre contraption that vibrated when plugged in, with something more practical. Then the door to the Rose Garden swung open. I looked up and saw Dad. "Mr. President," he said. He was wearing a dark suit, his hair still wet from the hot bath he'd taken to thaw out. "Mr. President," I replied. He stepped into the office, and I walked around the desk. We met in the middle of the room. Neither of us said much. We didn't need to. The moment was more moving than either of us could have expressed. On my 9th day as president, my domestic policy team gathered in the Oval Office. Everyone was on time. That was what I expected. Timeliness is important to make sure an organization does not get sloppy. The chief briefer that day was Margaret Spellings, a smart and feisty mother of two. Margaret had served with me in Austin and moved to Washington as my top domestic policy advisor. She covered a variety of topics that day, including a new initiative for people with disabilities and an election reform commission chaired by former presidents Ford and Carter. Then she launched into a discussion of embryonic stem cell research. The Clinton administration issued new legal guidelines that interpret the Dickey Amendment to permit federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. We have several options going forward. That's as far as she got before I cut her off. "First of all," I asked, "what exactly is a stem cell?" I learn best by asking questions. In some cases, I probe to understand a complex issue. Other times, I deploy questions as a way to test my briefer's knowledge. If they cannot answer concisely and in plain English, it raises a red flag that they may not fully grasp the subject. As usual, Margaret was well prepared. She started by explaining the science. Embryonic stem cells are a special medical resource because they can transform into a wide variety of different cell types. Just as the stem of a vine grows into many distinct branches, embryonic stem cells have the capacity to grow into nerve cells for the brain, muscle tissues for the heart, and other organs. These cells offered a possible way to treat ailments from juvenile diabetes to Alzheimer's to Parkinson's. The technology was new and the science was unproven, but the potential was significant. However, the only way to extract embryonic stem cells is to destroy the embryo. This raised a moral dilemma. Could the destruction of one human life be justified by the hopes of saving others? Congress's answer seemed clear. Every year since 1995, the House and Senate had passed legislation banning the use of federal funds for research in which human embryos were destroyed. The law was known as the Dickey Amendment, after its sponsor, Congressman Jay Dickey of Arkansas. In 1998, a researcher at the University of Wisconsin isolated an individual embryonic stem cell for the first time. As the cell divided, it created a multitude of other cells, called a line, that could be used for research. Soon after, the Clinton administration adopted a novel interpretation of the Dickey Amendment. Lawyers argued that taxpayer dollars could be used to support stem cell research on lines derived from destroyed embryos, as long as the destruction itself was funded by private sources. The National Institutes of Health prepared to award grants under those terms, but President Clinton's term ended before any funds were distributed. The immediate decision facing me was whether to allow those grants to proceed. It was clear this would be more than a funding dispute. The moral questions were profound. Is a frozen embryo a human life? If so, what responsibilities do we have to protect it? I told Margaret and Deputy Chief of Staff Josh Bolton that I considered this a far-reaching decision. I laid out a process for making it. I would clarify my guiding principles, listen to experts on all sides of the debate, reach a tentative conclusion, and run it past knowledgeable people. After finalizing a decision, I would explain it to the American people. Finally, I would set up a process to ensure that my policy was implemented. To run the process, Josh tapped Jay Lefkowitz, the General Counsel of the Office of Management and Budget, the agency that would oversee my funding policy. Jay was a thoughtful and lively lawyer from New York, with a serious commitment to his Jewish faith and a dry sense of humor. I liked him immediately. That was good because we were going to spend a lot of time together. Jay loaded me up with background reading. He included articles from medical journals, writings on moral philosophy and legal analysis. The readings he sent spanned the spectrum of viewpoints. In Science magazine, bioethicist Dr. Lewis Gannon argued, "If we spurn embryonic stem cell research, not one more baby is likely to be born. If we conduct research, we may relieve suffering." Those on the other side of the debate argued that government support for the destruction of human life would cross a moral line. Embryonic stem cell research takes us onto a path that would transform our perception of human life into a malleable, marketable, natural resource, akin to a cattle herd or copper mine, to be exploited for the benefit of the born and breathing, bioethics expert Wesley J. Smith wrote in National Review. At its core, the stem cell question harked back to the philosophical clash between science and morality. I felt pulled in both directions. I had no interest in joining the Flat Earth Society. I empathized with the hopes for new medical cures. I had lost a sister to childhood leukemia. I had served on the board of the Kent Waldrop National Paralysis Foundation, an advocacy group led by a former Texas Christian University football player who had suffered a spinal cord injury. I believed in the promise of science and technology to alleviate suffering and disease. During my presidential campaign, I had pledged to follow through on the commitment Congress made in the late 1990s to double funding for the National Institutes of Health. At the same time, I felt that technology should respect moral boundaries. I worried that sanctioning the destruction of human embryos for research would be a step down the slippery slope from science fiction to medical reality. I envision researchers cloning fetuses to grow spare body parts in a laboratory. I could foresee the temptation of designer babies that enabled parents to engineer their very own blonde-haired basketball player. Not far beyond that lies the nightmare of full-scale human cloning. I knew these possibilities would sound fanciful to some people, but once science started heading down that path, it would be very hard to turn back. The stem cell question overlapped with the abortion debate. It seemed hard to believe now, but abortion was not a major political issue when I was young. I don't remember it coming up much during Dad's early campaigns or in conversations at Andover or Yale. That changed in 1973, when the Supreme Court, in a decision Justice Byron White called an exercise in raw judicial power, deemed abortion a right protected by the Constitution. The abortion issue is difficult, sensitive, and personal. My faith and conscience led me to conclude that human life is sacred. God created man in His image, and therefore every person has value in His eyes. It seemed to me that an unborn child, while dependent on its mother, is a separate and independent being, worthy of protection in its own right. When I saw Barbara and Jenna on the sonogram for the first time, there was no doubt in my mind they were distinct and alive. The fact that they could not speak for themselves only enhanced society's duty to defend them. Many decent and thoughtful people disagreed, including members of my family. I understood their reasons and respected their views. As president, I had no desire to condemn millions as sinners or dump new fuel on raging cultural fires. I did not feel a responsibility to voice my pro-life convictions and lead the country toward what Pope John Paul II called a culture of life. I was convinced that most Americans agreed we would be better off with fewer abortions. One of my first acts in the White House was to reinstate the so-called Mexico City policy, which prevented federal funding for groups that promote abortion overseas. I supported state laws requiring parental notification for minors seeking abortions. And I supported, signed, and defended a bill banning the grisly practice of partial birth abortion. Laura and I were also strong supporters of adoption. After having difficulty conceiving children, it was hard for us to imagine anyone rejecting what we considered a precious gift. Yet as the father of daughters, I could envision the dilemma facing a scared teenager with an unplanned pregnancy. Adoption was such a positive alternative to abortion, a way to save one life and brighten two more, those of the adoptive parents. I was pleased to sign legislation increasing funding for crisis pregnancy counseling centers, as well as to expand tax credits to offset the costs of adoption. In the long run, I hoped a change in hearts would lead to a change in law, as new technologies like 3D ultrasounds help more Americans recognize the humanity of unborn babies. I also hoped political leaders would continue to speak out for a culture that values all innocent human life. Bob Casey, the late Democratic governor of Pennsylvania, said it well. When we look to the unborn child, the real issue is not when life begins, but when love begins. Beginning in the spring of 2001, Margaret, Jay, and Carl Rove, who was in close touch with advocacy groups on both sides of the issue, invited a series of distinguished scientists, ethicists, religious thinkers, and advocates to discuss embryonic stem cell research. The conversations fascinated me. The more I learned, the more questions I had. When I delivered the commencement address at Notre Dame, I brought up embryonic stem cell research with Father Ed Monk Malloy, the president of the university. When I spoke at Yale the next day, I raised the topic with Dr. Harold Varmus of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. At a birthday party for a doctor in the White House medical unit, I asked all the physicians there what they thought. As word got out that I was seeking opinions, I was bombarded with input from cabinet secretaries, staffers, outside advisors, and friends. Of course, I asked Laura for her advice. Her father had died of Alzheimer's. Her mother had suffered from breast cancer, and she held out great hope for the possibility of new cures. But she worried that advocacy groups would overpromise what embryonic stem cell research could achieve, leaving desperate families with dashed hopes. Members of the scientific community presented two main arguments in favor of funding embryonic stem cell research. First was the medical potential. Researchers told me there were millions of Americans suffering from diseases that might be alleviated through treatments derived from embryonic stem cells. Experts believed that only a few stem cell lines would be needed to explore the science and determine its value. If we had 10 to 15 lines, no one would complain, Irv Weissman, a prominent researcher from Stanford, told the New York Times. A research team from the National Institutes of Health told me that several dozen stem cell lines were already under development. They also reported some preliminary research into alternative ways of deriving stem cells without destroying embryos. Their unanimous opinion was that denying federal support for embryonic stem cell research would result in a missed opportunity. Taxpayer dollars were important not only as a source of financing, they explained, but also as a seal of approval for scientific innovation. The scientists' second point was a practical one. Most of the embryos used to derive the stem cells would likely be discarded anyway. The primary source of these embryos was in vitro fertilization, IVF clinics. When a couple signed up for IVF, doctors usually fertilized more eggs than they implanted in the prospective mother. As a result, some embryos would be left after the treatment was complete. They were usually frozen and stored by the fertility clinic. Since these so-called spare embryos were not going to be used to conceive children, scientists argued, didn't it make sense to use them for research that could potentially save lives? One of the groups most actively supporting embryonic stem cell research was the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. In July 2001, I invited representatives from the organization to the Oval Office. Among the delegation were two friends of mine, Woody Johnson and Mike Overlock. Both men were political backers, and both had children suffering from diabetes. They were passionate, compelling advocates with an unmistakable devotion to their children. But their certainty about a rapid embryonic stem cell breakthrough surprised me. When I pointed out that the science was unproven, and there could be alternatives to embryo destruction, it was obvious that the advocacy group had left no room for doubt in their minds. The meeting was a window into the passion the issue could generate. That same day, I also met representatives of National Right to Life. They opposed any research that destroyed embryos. They pointed out that each tiny stem cell cluster had the potential to grow into a person. In fact, all of us had started our lives in this early state. As evidence, they pointed to a new program run by Nightlight Christian Adoptions. The agency secured permission from IVF participants to place their unused frozen embryos up for adoption. Loving mothers had the embryos implanted in them and carried the babies, known as snowflakes, to term. The message was unmistakable. Within every frozen embryo were the beginnings of a child. Many of the bioethicists I met took the same position. They acknowledged that most embryos frozen in IVF clinics would not become children. Yet they argued that there was a moral difference between allowing embryos to die naturally and proactively ending their lives. Sanctioning the destruction of life to save life, they argued, crossed into dangerous moral territory. As one put it, the fact that a being is going to die does not entitle us to use it as a natural resource for exploitation. I heard some opinions that surprised me. Dr. Dan Callahan, a thoughtful ethicist, told me he was pro-choice on abortion but against embryonic stem cell research. He believed there was a moral distinction between aborting a baby for the direct benefit of its mother and destroying an embryo for the vague and indirect purpose of scientific research. Dr. Benjamin Carson, one of the world's most respected surgeons, told me that stem cell research could be valuable, but that scientists should focus on alternatives to embryo destruction, such as collecting stem cells from the blood of umbilical cords. On the other hand, Orrin Hatch and Strom Thurmond, two of the most staunchly pro-life members of the Senate, supported federal funding for embryonic stem cell research because they thought the benefit of saving lives outweighed the cost of destroying embryos. In July 2001, I visited Pope John Paul II at his beautiful summer residence, Castel Gandolfo. Swiss guards in full regalia escorted us through a series of rooms and into the reception area. Pope John Paul II was one of the great figures in modern history. A survivor of Nazi and communist rule in his native Poland, he had become the first non-Italian pope in 455 years. With his call, "Be not afraid," he rallied the conscience of Central and Eastern Europe to bring down the Iron Curtain. As the distinguished Cold War historian John Lewis Gaddis later wrote, "When John Paul II kissed the ground at the Warsaw airport on June 2, 1979, he began the process by which communism in Poland, and ultimately everywhere else in Europe, would come to an end." By 2001, the Holy Father's vigor and energy had given way to frailty. His movements were deliberate, his speech soft and slow, yet his eyes sparkled. He was filled with an unmistakable spirit. He gingerly walked Laura, our daughter Barbara, and me to a balcony where we marveled at gorgeous Lake Albano below. He and I then retired to a simple meeting room where we discussed a variety of issues, including stem cell research. He understood the promise of science. The Holy Father himself was stricken with Parkinson's. Yet he was firm in his view that human life must be protected in all its forms. I thanked him for his example of principled leadership. I explained that the Catholic Church's steadfast support of life provided a firm moral foundation on which pro-life politicians like me could take a stand. I told him I hoped the Church would always be a rock in the defense of human dignity. When the Holy Father passed away in 2005, Laura, Dad, Bill Clinton, and I flew together to his funeral in Rome. It was the first time an American president had attended the funeral of a pope, let alone brought two of his predecessors. Shortly after we arrived, we went to pay our respects to the Holy Father while he was lying in state. As we knelt at the communion rail to pray over his body, Laura turned to me and said, "Now is the time to pray for miracles." An unexpected impulse came over me. I prayed for Peter Jennings, the ABC News anchor who was dying of cancer. The funeral mass was incredibly moving. The crowd in St. Peter's Square cheered, sang, and carried banners celebrating the Holy Father's life. After a homily by Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, who 11 days later emerged from the conclave as Pope Benedict XVI, a group of church officials carried the Holy Father's casket up the stairs towards St. Peter's Basilica. Just before entering the doors, they turned to face the crowd and lifted the coffin for a last time. As they did, the clouds parted, and the sun shined through onto the simple wooden box. After several months of listening and reflecting, I was close to a decision on stem cell research. A defining moment came in a conversation with Leon Cass on July 10th. Leon was a highly respected physician and philosophy professor at the University of Chicago. He had written and taught in fields as diverse as evolutionary biology, literature, and the Bible. He struck me as a thoughtful and wise man. I told Leon I had been wrestling with the decision. Embryonic stem cell research seemed to offer so much hope, yet it raised troubling moral concerns. I wondered if it was possible to find a principled policy that advanced science while respecting the dignity of life. Leon's logical mind went to work. He argued that embryos, even those long frozen, had the potential for life and thus deserved some form of respect. "One goes with a heavy heart if we use these things," he said. "We at least owe them the respect not to manipulate them for our own purposes. We are dealing with the seeds of the next generation." I shared an idea. What if I authorized federal funding for embryonic stem cell research, but solely for existing stem cell lines? The embryos used to create those lines had been destroyed. There was no way to get them back. It seemed logical to let scientists use them to pursue treatments that might save other lives. But that raised another question. If I allowed federal funding for research that relied on destroyed embryos, would I be tacitly encouraging further destruction? Leon said he believed that funding research on already destroyed embryos would be ethical with two conditions. I must reaffirm the moral principle that had been violated, in this case, the dignity of human life. And I must make clear that federal funds would not be used in the further destruction of embryos. So long as I did both, he said, the policy would pass the ethical test. If you fund research on lines that have already been developed, he said, you are not complicit in their destruction. The conversation with Leon crystallized my thinking. I decided that the government would fund research on stem cell lines derived from embryos that had already been destroyed. At the same time, I would ask Congress to increase federal funding for alternative sources of stem cells that brought no ethical controversy. And I would draw a firm moral line. Federal tax dollars would not be used to support the destruction of life for medical gain. I also created a new presidential bioethics council, composed of experts from all backgrounds and chaired by Leon Cass. The next step was to announce the decision to the American people. Karen suggested a rare primetime speech to the nation. When the president addresses the nation in primetime, he usually speaks as commander-in-chief. In this case, I would be speaking as educator-in-chief. I like the idea. Stem cell research was a serious issue for the nation, but an obscure one for most citizens, as it had been for me in January. Explaining my decision would be almost as important as making it. On August 9, 2001, I addressed a nationwide network TV audience from Crawford, Texas, definitely a first in presidential history. The night before the speech, Laura and I had dinner with Jay, Karen, and her son Robert, and a family friend, Fort Worth interior designer Ken Blasingham. I asked Jay to say a prayer before we began the meal. He delivered some thoughtful words. As he finished, we all kept our heads bowed, waiting for the amen. After a few seconds of hanging, Jay told us that Jewish prayers don't always end with amen. It was a fitting conclusion to a process filled with learning. Good evening, I began my address. I appreciate you giving me a few minutes of your time tonight so I can discuss with you a complex and difficult issue, an issue that is one of the most profound of our time. I outlined the dilemma. While we must devote enormous energy to conquering disease, I said, it is equally important that we pay attention to the moral concerns raised by the new frontier of human embryo stem cell research. Even the most noble ends do not justify any means. Near the end, I pivoted to my decision. Embryonic stem cell research offers both great promise and great peril, so I have decided we must proceed with great care. I have concluded that we should allow federal funds to be used for research on these existing stem cell lines, where the life and death decision has already been made. Leading scientists tell me research on these 60 lines has great promise that could lead to breakthrough therapies and cures. This allows us to explore the promise and potential of stem cell research without crossing a fundamental moral line, by providing taxpayer funding that would sanction or encourage further destruction of human embryos that have at least the potential for life. I have made this decision with great care, and I pray it is the right one. For weeks before the speech, I had felt a sense of anxiety. I'd constantly questioned my assumptions and weighed the options again and again. With the decision made, I felt a sense of calm. I didn't know what the reaction would be. We hadn't commissioned a focus group or taken a poll. Just as we had waited for the amen at the end of Jay's prayer, we settled in to await the response. Reaction to my stem cell decision poured in quickly. Many politicians and activists on both sides praised the policy as reasonable and balanced. While some scientists and advocacy groups responded with disappointment, many welcomed the unprecedented federal funding as a vote of confidence in their work. The head of the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation issued a statement saying, "We applaud the president for supporting embryonic stem cell research." My friend, Kent Waldrop, The paralyzed TCU football player on whose advocacy board I used to sit told a reporter, "It does everything the scientific community needs, and I think a little bit more." To the degree that I faced criticism, it came from the right. One conservative activist compared my decision to Nazi conduct during the Holocaust. Another said, "I am ashamed of our president who compromises and gives my generation the mentality that human life can be picked apart, abused, and destroyed." The spokesman for the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops said, "I seem to be the only man in America who is against the president's policy." His loneliness did not last long. The tone of the debate quickly became heated and harsh. Looking back, it is clear that a toxic pair of factors had converged: money and politics. Many of the first to turn against the policy were scientists. By providing some federal funding, I had whetted their appetite for more. In the spring of 2002, I addressed a major complaint by allowing privately funded embryonic stem cell research to be conducted at facilities that received federal dollars. It was an important step, but it did not satisfy the scientists, who constantly demanded more. Advocacy groups quickly followed. Their high hopes for new cures had led them to make unrealistic promises. They seemed to feel that limiting the number of stem cells available for research would delay breakthroughs. They recruited well-meaning Hollywood stars to tug at heartstrings. They also discovered that the issue could help them raise large amounts of money. Some, who had initially supported my decision, transformed into vocal critics. Politicians recognized that they, too, could capitalize on the issue. By 2004, Democrats had concluded that stem cell research was a political winner. It allowed them to open a new front in the abortion debate while also claiming the mantle of compassion. Candidates across the country ran TV ads that highlighted the benefits of embryonic stem cell research without mentioning that the science was unproven, the morality was in doubt, and ethical alternatives existed. The Democratic presidential nominee, Senator John Kerry, campaigned hard on the issue. Kerry frequently criticized what he called a ban on embryonic stem cell research. I pointed out that there was no such ban. To the contrary, I was the first president in history to fund embryonic stem cell research. Plus, there were no restrictions on funding from the private sector. Nonetheless, Kerry's campaign used stem cell research as the foundation for a broader attack, labeling my positions anti-science. The charge was false. I had supported science by funding alternative stem cell research, promoting clean energy development, increasing federal spending on technology research, and launching a global AIDS initiative. Yet the demagoguery continued all the way up to the election. The low point came in October, when Kerry's running mate, Senator John Edwards, told a political rally in Iowa that if Kerry became president, people like Christopher Reeve will get up out of that wheelchair and walk again. The famous actor who played Superman, Reeve was confined to a wheelchair after a horse-riding accident. Sadly, he died in October 2004, one day before Edwards' statement. The stem cell debate was an introduction to a phenomenon I witnessed throughout my presidency. Highly personal criticism. Partisan opponents and commentators questioned my legitimacy, my intelligence, and my sincerity. They mocked my appearance, my accent, and my religious beliefs. I was labeled a Nazi, a war criminal, and Satan himself. That last one came from a foreign leader, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. One lawmaker called me both a loser and a liar. He became majority leader of the U.S. Senate. In some ways, I wasn't surprised. I had endured plenty of rough politics in Texas. I had seen Dad and Bill Clinton derided by their opponents and the media. Abraham Lincoln was compared to a baboon. Even George Washington became so unpopular that political cartoons showed the hero of the American Revolution being marched to a guillotine. Yet the death spiral of decency during my time in office, exacerbated by the advent of 24-hour cable news and hyper-partisan political blogs, was deeply disappointing. The toxic atmosphere in American politics discourages good people from running for office. Over time, the petty insults and name-calling hardened into conventional wisdom. Some have said I should have pushed back harder against the caricatures, but I felt it would debase the presidency to stoop to the critics' level. I had run on a promise to change the tone in Washington. I took that vow seriously and tried to do my part, but I rarely succeeded. The shrill debate never affected my decisions. I read a lot of history, and I was struck by how many presidents had endured harsh criticism. The measure of their character, and often their success, was how they responded. Those who based decisions on principle, not some snapshot of public opinion, were often vindicated over time. George Washington once wrote that leading by conviction gave him a consolation within that no earthly efforts can deprive me of. He continued, "The arrows of malevolence, however barbed and well pointed, never can reach the most vulnerable part of me." I read those words in Presidential Courage, written by historian Michael Beschloss in 2007. As I told Laura, if they're still assessing George Washington's legacy more than two centuries after he left office, this George W. doesn't have to worry about today's headlines. Far from the yelling on the TV sets and the campaign trail, my stem cell policy quietly moved forward in the labs. For the first time in history, scientists received federal grants to support embryonic stem cell research. Scientists also used new federal funding for alternative stem cell research to explore the potential of adult bone marrow, placentas, amniotic fluid, and other non-embryonic sources. Their research yielded new treatments for patients suffering from dozens of diseases, free of moral drawbacks. For example, doctors discovered a way to collect stem cells harmlessly from the blood of umbilical cords to treat patients suffering from leukemia and sickle cell anemia. Much of this research was overseen by Dr. Elias Zerhouni, the talented Algerian-American I appointed to lead the NIH. I had put Elias in a tough position. He felt trapped between a president he had agreed to serve and the scientific community of which he was part. He did not agree with my embryonic stem cell policy, yet he was more interested in new cures than in politics. He funded the alternative stem cell sources aggressively, and a good deal of credit for the breakthroughs in the field belongs to Dr. Zerhouni and his team of professionals at the NIH. Unfortunately, most members of Congress paid more attention to politics than to scientific discoveries. As the 2006 elections approached, Democrats made clear they would again use the issue as a political weapon. A U.S. Senate candidate in Missouri persuaded Michael J. Fox, who suffers from Parkinson's, to attack her opponent in statewide TV ads. Some Republicans who had initially supported the policy feared for their seats and changed their minds. In July 2006, the House and Senate considered a bill that would overturn my stem cell policy by permitting federal funds for research that destroyed human life. 5.5 years into the presidency, I had yet to veto a piece of legislation. I had worked closely with our congressional